One more thing for Eric to repair. Now, this club has roughly 400 members. Therefore, the club leadership, has assigned a fairly large staff of people who have repair capability, who all answer to Eric. So Eric has this pretty large staff of people that can go to the various sites maintaining all of this equipment, and therefore he doesn't run himself ragged and have to do it all himself. Isn't that roughly the way it is, Eric? I'm pulling his leg here. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
No, I would advise you not make me unhappy, because then there would be a very large number of unhappy people. So be careful there. Actually, because of the low activity there, I'm considering, or rather the club is considering, or I am proposing, that we expand our DMR coverage in lieu of the inactivity there. I don't know if most people are aware, we spend a good hefty number of dollars in order to have these repeaters in the places that they are, and we're literally charged by the antenna, so to speak. So it's not just as simple as, you know, put up additional piece of equipment and voila, lo and behold, you have an additional charge to your large expense. So it might be expedient to keep the same number of antennas, but change the utilization, so to speak. But that's something that the board would have to consider. But yeah, that's something else they got to fix. Let me let it drop for a second.
Eric, how popular is the DMR?
Actually, it is quite considerable. It does get quite a lot of use, believe it or not. There are times when it's quiet as all heck, and then there's times where, because of the way it's channelized, it's hard to get in because it's busy, busy, busy. It is a more modern technology. It's at an iron's length for a lot of people because the radios are pretty cheap. The funny thing that I was going to say about doing 1.2 is that my service monitor only goes up to 999. So I have to find some indirect method, or if I'm lucky, I'll bring it to work where I've got something that goes out to 26 gigs. But, the last time I had to fix it, it's a little tough to work on without being able to see it directly.
Steve Keezer with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal, and then I've got another comment for Eric. Hal, you got it.
Eric, I have some 1.2 stuff that I'm working on, and basically I take a IFR 1000S, I use it at 600, I recalibrate it to a known receiver to get a setting as far as microvolts on the second harmonic, and I've had no problem working 1.2 with an IFR 1000 sugar.
Oh, lucky you, there's lots of ways to skin a cat. That's your method. I have my ways, too. It's more fun if you had something that goes directly on frequency. But actually, I picked up something. If I can fix it, then I won't have that problem in the future.
Eric, when it comes to DMR on either 2 meters or 450, I am guessing there's a fair number of commercially made rigs with DMR capability that can be reprogrammed for amateur service, and therefore a person desiring DMR capability has a number of rigs he can select from, some of them probably pretty expensive and probably some of them a little bit less expensive. When it comes to 1288 megacycle and DMR, is there an equal number of rigs there, or are we running into a multiple problem here, where that is the number of amateurs willing to go to 1288 is a little bit low. You have to be quite progressive to go that high. You get a nosebleed when you go up that high in frequency. And the total number of rigs they can buy that they can select might be a small number. Maybe I'm wrong. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K2EJ. I might be the wrong one to ask about DMR radios being up to 1200. Now, Mr. Druckmann, Mr. Schuchter in the commercial world would be more capable of answering that question, but I know that there's stuff at 800 and 900, so. And you have the normal manufacturers like Motorola and Kenwood and this one and that one and Harris. The Chinese DMR manufacturer is actually an American-based company marketing a particular product, sells directly to him, and there's a couple of others that sell directly to him, and the prices start at like $150, sometimes you can see them a little less, to the Motorola versions, which is like in the $400 and $500 range, or even more, depending upon whatever toys you want to get in it. But most of the manufacturers, actually all the manufacturers, are designing specifically for the commercial market, not him.
We're going to get back to Steve in a minute, so hang in there, Steve. When it comes to 900 megs, I may be a little bit foggy brained here. I don't think I remember Limark having a 900 meg repeater. There's good and bad news about 900 megs. 902 to 928, you got, 26 megs of frequency which you can use. It's very lightly used by the hams, therefore you would own those frequencies, so to speak. That's the good news. And then one other piece of good news is when it comes to surplus-made telephone circuits that were made for cell sites, there are a number of high-power amplifiers that you can buy for very nice prices that put out as much as 600 watts on 900 megacycles. That's the good news. The bad news of 900 megs, there's a hell of a lot of other services there which are now using frequency hopping services, and they could be quite annoying. So my guess is there's been, when it comes to Limark considering a 902 so-called repeater, I'll bet you're, we've looked at it, and we've seen the good and the bad and decided not to make a jump into that. I'm making some guesses on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Pull some of the cobwebs out of the back of your head there. If you remember, the link between Sheldon and Glen Oaks was in the 902 region. And having a 902 receiver, 928, whichever end of the band you wanted to pick, at the building with all those 900 megahertz cell phones, room phones, plus the alarm circuits, the water metering stuff and everything else, if you've ever taken a spectrum analyzer to that band, it's literally useless in certain locations. I mean, you move away from the high density areas, you get a little put off. There are a bunch of 900 megahertz repeaters out there. And the flat of the spectrum stuff is not as bad a problem as it is when you're located in a building that has more of it than you can possibly imagine. So there's good and there's bad. You get away from the metro areas, 902 is a wonderful band. In the metro areas, forget it. You can't do a thing.
Okay, cobwebs removed, Eric. I was well aware that 900 megs has been used by Limark for linking services. But when I look at the list of repeaters that Limark has established and maintains, 900 megacycles is not there. So I was guessing that Limark presently does not have a 900 meg repeater. And I'm wondering, has it been discussed in the past, the pros and cons, as to whether or not there should be one? Because many amateurs, they put their toe in the water slowly. When it comes to going to higher, more progressive frequencies, I think it would be easier to talk a Limark member into a 900 meg radio than a 1200 meg radio. That's just my guess. So has 900 megs as a repeater been discussed? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay, K2RIW, K2EJ, based upon what I know, and in my experience of the sites that support these operations, the sites that we rent, even with a really nice 900 repeater, with real cool filters that are sharper than you can imagine, they ain't going to help a lot. Whereas I know of many other 900 locations where it's absolutely beautiful. So as far as this club is concerned, I've don't recommend it. If anything, you know, DMR is a new thing for a lot of folks, and to expand our coverage, I think, is the next worthwhile endeavor. I mean, we had these thoughts of grandeur when we first started it, because there's a lot of interesting things you can do with DMR, because it is so IP-based, including ganging the analog into the digital and a whole bunch of other things. Because it is a commercial environment, so to speak, and we're working with proprietary protocols at a certain level of it, you have to buy a licensed piece of software, which means more money. Let me write this up. And since there is a larger group out there that's already been established that has welcomed us into their group and has the ability to handle more connections without us having to spend any money at all, we chose that. So, when we started, I imagined us doing great things, but, you know, how do you justify it in the end? The capability is there, it's expansive. If in the next couple of years the codec improves and people want to, or the big manufacturers move to it, then the firmware will change. Because all the codecs today, the interesting thing about DMR is they use this thing called an OMAP chip, which is basically a RISC processor along with a DSP in the same package. So all the codec and all the information in these radios is totally software. And it's interesting the way you could just change the codec. So the whole system could change overnight, literally. Get your IW, KJJ.
Question, WS2N.
Paul recognized. Yeah, what I've heard, Paul, is that there are some great locations where 900 megs would be a good working repeater. The particular sites that Limark owns happens to be some of the best, very high sites. Therefore, some of the spread spectrum people on 900 megs are also there. Therefore, we could get a lot of local electromagnetic interference that would be hard to live with. That's part of the reason why I guess Limark doesn't currently have of their own position a 900 meg. WS2N, K2RW. Go ahead, Paul. And by the way, Paul, we're looking forward to hearing what SpaceX did with that tail landing at Cape Canaveral. Boy, that's that is a bit of a breakthrough. You got it, Paul.
82HUC with a question.
Paul first and HUC later. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that was history. We'll talk about that later. Real good job by SpaceX. 902. If I had a transmitter receiver set up for that band, I'm wondering if I would get interference. I have a weather radio, and it transmits the temperature. You know, the transmitter is outside, and it transmits actually on 915. I wonder if that would be a problem. You know, I'm just curious. I mean, it transmits every like 4 seconds. This thing is going. Back to you, Dick.
Let's see if Eric's got an answer on that one. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, don't forget, we are secondary users, we're not primary users of the band. Once you get away from the place where there's 1,000 radio transmitters and it's like your home, 915 is real cool. Actually, there's a lot of license-free stuff there. If you're not in a very crowded neighborhood and you don't have a lot of young kids with, wireless nanny cams, although a lot of that stuff is moving up to the 2.4 gig unlicensed band, but you shouldn't have a problem.
Okay, we're going to get back to Steve, MDP, who's got a 1288 megacycle question. But Steve, KD2HUC, you had something you wanted to say or ask. HUC, go ahead, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, as we're talking about 1.2 gigs, I was just looking around. Looks like you could probably do a decent 1.2 gigahertz setup for about $1,000. Transceiver, decent omnidirectional antenna, and, you know, decent coax in between. But, you know, what is the... Most of those transceivers that I was seeing, they really don't have anything else to offer
you know, they're not really multi-band. They're kind of specialty, it looks like. I mean, unless you're going up into buku money. But is there, you know, what is the real benefit, especially if the repeater is not, you know, heavily traveled and there's not a lot there? And also, are there any other considerations, like, you know, do you need a tower like you have in order to make it, you know, communications viable over a decent distance? Or, you know, will the 1.2 gig, you know, travel relatively easy? You know, I know very little about that band, so I'm just asking. KD2HUC.
It turns out you're right on the money, Steve. You hit the nail on the head. 1296 megacycle ham band. The good news is it's got a lot of bandwidth. It's very light in use, and therefore you go there, you own it, so to speak, even though it's a shared assignment. However, if I compare the exact same number of watts of transmitter and receiver, and let's say a repeater, on 1296, 1288, versus, let's say, 2 meters, you will find, in general, less range. In general, the equipment is more expensive. In general, the equipment is not multiband. You're not going to find a handy talkie made by Waxon for $50. Whereas on 2 meters and 450, yes, you can do that. So there's a number of impediments to 1200 megacycle ham radio becoming real popular. There's some very progressive clubs that go there simply because they have a philosophy that no frequency is too high or no frequency is high enough, and they want to go into the wide open spaces. They want to go to the frontier. You can develop some fairly exotic, rather high gain, omnidirectional repeater antennas out of the 1200 megacycle band, and they're a hell of a lot more compact, and the whip antenna on your car is a lot more compact. There's a couple of pluses, but there's a significant number of minuses, and not many guys, a rather small percentage of the ham radio operators have gone there. I'm a member of, let me drop.
Yeah.
I'm a member of some of the microwave groups, like the San Bernardino Microwave Society, the North Texas Microwave Society, the New England Weak Signal Society, and so on. And the really progressive members are going to the 1 gig, 2 gig, 3 gig, 5 gig, and 10 gig bands. And they're doing it because it's a frontier. They like experimenting in brand new equipment. And there's a number of motivations they have that are significantly different from the average 2-meter repeater operator per se. So whether or not you go there, it takes a slightly different philosophy of life for you to be driven to go there and enjoy it and talk to your fellow buddies. The people who are doing serious microwave work ham radio-wise, there's roughly one of them per 500 hams. There's roughly one ham per 500 people in the general population. So as you can see, you're starting to get down to the creme de la creme here. Somebody else had a comment. Who was that? KQRIW?
It was just me. There actually is quite a bit of video usage on 1296. And actually, some digital stuff. So there's not in this neck of the woods, but in a lot of the rest of the country, there's repeaters and whatnot doing video.
So as you can see, Steve, these higher frequencies with greater number of megacycles assigned to ham radio operators give you all kinds of other capability. Video, for instance, is very nice. Slight fast scan video. However, you'll be very disappointed to find out that whether you're on the 439 megacycle video band or the 1200 megacycle video band, when you go from audio to video, fast scan video, live, you know, full speed video like broadcast, you'll be amazed what you lose in range, because the receiver has to be a number of megacycles wide as opposed to a number of kilohertz wide. You suffer a 40, 50, 60 decibel disadvantage in range, signal-to-noise ratio, and whatever. To transmit video, unless you've got a fairly short number of miles of line of sight, to transmit video in any of these frequencies, and you think you're going to do video DXing without a significant band opening, just by pure ground wave, there's a number of disadvantages. There's pluses and minuses. Video is exciting, without a doubt. But the guys who go there, it definitely separates the men from the boys. They got to put out a lot more power and a lot higher antenna to get any significant amount of range. The good news is that the World Trade Center did have a video repeater transmitter on that at one time. Give us a couple of words on that one, Eric, if you remember. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Yeah, I should be ashamed of myself. I can't remember the guy's name. He was an engineer at NBC. They had the antennas set up right behind the windows, looking out east. And of course, later I'll think of his name. But yeah, that was there for many years until the building went bye-bye.
So if you're transmitting ham radio fast scan video from the Empire State Building or the World Trade Center,
Bill Stockman.
Is that the right name, Eric? Yeah, I think the man was one of the broadcast engineers working at the World Trade, and I believe he lost his life during that collapse of that building. Now, Steve, you had some further questions about 1288. We now know that it's not your failed equipment. It looks like Barry has confirmed for us that at this time that repeater is not on the working list, and so it's on Eric's list of things to be repaired. KC2MDP with his further second question. K2RAW the tech man.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Yes, thank you, Barry, for confirming that. That solved a lot of my headaches, and sorry, Eric, to be the bearer of bad news and give you another headache for you to work on. Okay, Dick, yeah, the problem is mobile. It's the 1.2, and I have a mag mount, and it's an NMO mag mount, and the SW was high, and basically I noticed a little tongue in there. Wasn't making a good contact. So I cleaned that up. I cleaned the antenna up. I got it down to like maybe a 1.5, 1.6. I try adjusting the antenna, you know, slide the rod up and down, and it basically stays the same. Now, here's the funny part. When I take the antenna off the NMO mount and just have the mount, no antenna on it, I get a 1.2 SWR. I screw it back on. Maybe it's a 1.6. Now, is there a cutoff point for a mag mount as far as frequency? Back to you.
E6TPZ with the comments.
Yeah, I doubt it. Let's see if Hal knows what's going on there. You got it, Hal.
Sounds like the coax got pinched, and you don't have a constant surge impedance in that coax. That's why you're getting all sorts of strange readings.
Okay, Steve, that's a guess. It's going to take a little bit further testing. And by the way, one of the things we'll be discussing later on tonight, if we get a chance, is the so-called distance to fault function. If you buy the right kind of a service monitor these days, you can buy a function which I call the Steinhelfer function, because Mr. Steinhelfer and his son invented it way back in 1969. It's a kind of a fast Fourier transform where you force your service monitor to hop to a number of frequencies and make measurements of amplitude and phase of the reflected signal at each of those frequencies. You put that into this computer program, which is called a Fourier transform, and it will give you a display of how much reflection you're getting at each number of the feet downrange on the cable. They call it distance to fault. So if you had a pinched cable, for instance, an open circuit, a short circuit, or whatever, you would know with that particular function. If you can borrow somebody's service monitor that has that function, you'll find out exactly how many inches or feet downrange is the error, if there is an error. Let me drop like another comment. But the basic NMO structure, can it work at 1200 megacycles? Absolutely. And by the way, if the 1.5 standing wave ratio that you got is not cable insertion loss, I could have a really yucky antenna on the far end of a piece of cable. But if the piece of cable had water in it, for instance, so if the cable is very lossy, even though the signal goes down, hits the antenna, and all of it reflects back, because it's been through the insertion loss of the cable twice, you'll measure a nice low standing wave ratio, like 1.5. You could have a perfect short circuit or open circuit antenna, and if the cable is lossy enough, by the way, 1.5 standing wave ratio, it's about 20 dB. So if you had 10 decibels of cable loss, which is 20 dB of loss round trip, you'd never measure more than a 1.5 standing wave ratio, even though there's a dead short at the far end. So you've got to worry a little bit about that. But once you confirm that your cable is not doing something terrible, if the 1.5 is really the antenna with the whip on it, 1.5 is not very bad. That's only a quarter of a dB of loss of potential signal being transmitted. The average guy will consider a 1.5 a pretty darn good match. And you're a little bit more of a scientist, Steve, and you want to do better than that. But you're shining up a lily when you do that. You don't really have to. KC2MDP. Oh, here, yeah, KC2MDP. K2RIZ. You got it, Steve.
Yes, Dick. Yeah, I'm very happy with the 1.5. The things that throw me off is the 1296 repeater being offline. I mean, like everyone said, there's no one really there, so it's not you can even really listen to it. And the other thing that threw me off is why was I getting a 2.0 SWR with no antenna on that NMO mount? And, yes, one thing is to look for water. It's not a very good mount. It's one of these 3-inch jobs, real cheaply made. And it's been on the car for a couple of years, so I might just change the mount. And the reason I asked this question is HRO, they have, you know, a million different mounts, and they have one that says it's good to 1,300 megahertz. Now, that's the reason I asked the main question. Is there a cutoff as far as frequency on a mag mount? Back to you.
With proper design procedures, absolutely not. I am convinced a mag mount properly designed could be used at 5 gigs. I'm convinced of that. Now, is the particular NMO mag mount that you own, the fact that you remove the whip and the remaining impedance matching structure, which is maybe inside of a plastic housing, the fact that it by itself has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, might not be strange, then again it might. I would get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which is 10 dB return loss, if I had 5 dB of cable loss into a short circuit, or an open circuit. Possibly when you remove the whip from the NMO, the antenna thinks it's an open circuit, and if you had 5 dB of loss in the cable, you would measure a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Right? You'd measure 2-to-1. You'd measure a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So, you got a little bit of a mystery there. And by the way, changing the length and you can't get it below 1.5-to-1 suggests that you've solved the reactive component, but you haven't yet got a perfect match of the resistive component. And there's ways of doing that. By way of an antenna analyzer, in theory, you can find out exactly what's going on with that antenna, or you can actually start doing a number of experiments by, say, for instance, taking a piece of copper tape. Let me drop it. If you put a piece of copper tape, let's say a 1 square inch of copper tape, and you put it near the tip, not above the tip, near the tip of the whip, and you've got this extra copper flag on the rod of the whip, and you put it near the top and find out if the visual get better or worse, then try putting it in the middle, then putting it in the bottom. By simple gimmicking techniques like that, you all of a sudden have control of the reactive component and the resistive component. And if you wanted to, you might find a way, as a scientist, of getting below 1.5 visuar. But if the 1.5 visuar is all by the antenna, and if it's real, you don't really have to go any further other than the scientists of you that want to know what's going on. So it looks to me like a little bit more inspection is required here. A good visual inspection might tell you whether or not you've got water in the cable, whether or not there's a frayed braid on the cable, and so on. So after a number of years of service in the pretty rugged environment of a mobile mag mount antenna being hit with wind, rain, trees, ice, snow, and whatever, it's time for a pretty thorough inspection, maybe with some antenna analyzer testing, Steve. And come back in the future weeks and let us know what you find out. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is DPZ with a comment.
DPZ.
Just on VHF, UHF, what antenna are you using? VHF, UHF, or what?
He said it was a 1288 antenna. Hal, go ahead.
Okay, well, chances are this is Riggy has a sampler in it for SWR Or can he, if he takes his rig, number one, and goes into a terminated dummy load, and he has so much output from the rig on the indicator, let's say, with the sampler, and then he connects it to this antenna cable, if he terminates in low power, 50-ohm resistor at the end of the cable, see if you simulate the same amount of power going out. You know, if you don't have an SWR meter for that frequency, or else if you have an SWR meter, just terminate the end of that cable with 51 ohm, low resistor, run the power way low, this ratio will be constant, and see if you have a flat line.
Hal, you may have misunderstood. He is using a standing wave ratio meter, probably a Berg, rated for 1288, right at the connector of the input cable of the antenna. And he's measuring those rather low standing wave ratios. Why are you asking for putting a dummy load on that? Over to you, Hal.
And that'll be the instrumentation he has. Let him go from the rig to a Berg at the other end of the cable where it's at the mount. Put a termination there and see if you drop to a 1-to-1. If you don't, then you have a bad cable.
Are you asking him to rip the cable out of an NMO mount in order to put a dummy load there? Is that what you're asking him to do? I'm misunderstanding something here.
Rip it out. Take the NMO antenna off. Go on the top there, attach the center to the outside part of the NMO mount with a terminated resistor, and see if it drops to 1-to-1. That's what I'm asking him to do.
Okay, Hal, in my opinion, that would be a necessary but not sufficient test. If he got a good standing wave ratio that way, but he still has a lot of cable loss because of water or whatever, he'd get a good VSWR reading. Then I guess you're saying try short and open to see if the reading then gets high. Okay, there's ways of doing that confirmation, Steve. Let's see if Steve needs any further words of explanation on what we just said. KC2MDP, K2LAW, go ahead, Steve.
Yes, Dick. Yes, I understand what you say, especially about the part with the little copper tape to try and make the SWR low. Can I go the other way, basically, and try and make this antenna so horrible and see if it goes above that 2.0 that I'm getting without the antenna? Do you think that would work?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here. One of the beautiful tests that usually works, but not always, if I can put a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit on the far end of a transmission line, and if I got good instrumentation in the shack and I measure VSWR in the shack, that tells me 95% of the time what the insertion loss of the cable is. Because in theory, the signal goes through the cable once, experiences the cable loss, hits the short circuit or open circuit, all of that signal reflects back and goes through the cable a second time. And so if I measured, for instance, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on the input end of my cable, when there's a perfect short circuit on the output end, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is roughly 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient total. That would mean I've got 4.5 dB of loss in the cable each way. On the assumption that the only reflecting device in the cable is the short circuit at the far end. If anything else is creating a short circuit in the middle of the cable, you'll also get that kind of a reading. And so what Hal is saying, he said dummy load, and I was picturing how in the world you take a coaxial connector dummy load and put it on an NMO. When I asked him again, now he made it more clear. You take a real 50 ohm and hang it on the connector of the NMO. Now I understand what he's saying. And at most VHF frequencies, that'll work like a charm. See if that makes a little bit more sense, Steve. KD2MDP. KC2MDP. K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, that makes a whole heck of a lot of sense. Yeah, basically just somehow finagle a 50-ohm resistor on the end of that NMO, get it on there, make it any way I can to make a decent connection, and, put the transmitter on low power and see what the SWR is.
Yeah, I've got an NMO to SO239.
Yeah, let's give some words on that one, Eric. I assume that most NMO connectors have a piece of coaxial cable that goes straight into it without a connector. Over to you, Eric, for clarification.
Yeah, there's this company called MFJ, and they make various different kinds of mobile antennas. Channel 259 on the bottom of it. And they supply you with a little gizmo, which is an NMO connector on one side, and an SO239 on the other, and it's mechanically strong enough to hold the antenna to the NMO connector. So if you happen to have one of those, you can screw a dummy load right into it and keep the whole thing shielded.
Where do I buy the thing, and roughly how many bucks, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, I can't imagine them more than like 10 or 15 bucks. And MFJ, the, you know, the people that make all the tuners and antennas and that stuff.
So-called mighty fine junk, but they do give you a lot of bang for the dollar, and quite a few of their products are quite good. So, alrighty. Eric, I mean, Steve, do you need more frills? And by the way, please tell us what you find as the 1288 repeater comes up, and as you do further experiments on your 1288 mobile mount antenna, we'll get to the bottom of all this, and we'd like to hear the next step of this mystery. KC2MDP for any other info, K2LIW.
Stick, very good. Yes, thank you, Eric. I will get on the computer and see if I can find that adapter as soon as I get off here. And yes, thank you, Dick. Great information as usual, and I will definitely let you know what I find next week.
Okay, yeah. What needs clarification, Wes? And then I'm going to pick up whoever is on Echo Link. Go ahead, Wes.
Whenever you have a mismatch of impedance between the transmission line and load, you will have a reflection. My question is actually, does it matter? Because you said perfect close or perfect open. That perfect short or perfect open doesn't make a difference, I think, but I might be wrong, for the transmitter and to engineer.
The average transmitter will really care about you not having a 50-ohm load on it. So it'll have one kind of grief with a short circuit. It'll have another kind of grief with an open circuit. It's going to behave differently. In general, that's not a good operating condition. So with most of the time, we want very little reflected signals from our transmission lines going to an antenna, because you'd like all that power to go in one direction one time and get radiated. That's sort of what you're asking, Wes, M2XJN, K2RIW.
Whether we have unterminated line, so we say perfect open, or we put the perfect short on it, the transmitter would see no difference. I mean, not much difference. I might be wrong in it, M2XJN.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that. The transmitter will see a tremendous difference. And the best way I can show you that is on a Smith chart. A Smith chart really is a polar diagram displaying amplitude and phase angle of reflected signal. That's what the Smith chart is really saying. I'm amazed how many people will read tremendous pages of instructions on how to use a Smith chart, and the basic operation of the thing, what's it really doing, is never made clear. It is a polar diagram showing you the amplitude of the reflected signal and the phase angle of the reflected signal. On that Smith chart, the far left-hand side at 9 o'clock is the short circuit. The far right-hand side at 3 o'clock is an open circuit. A general transmitter is going to be very unhappy in either case, but it's a different kind of unhappiness. Depending on how the final stage of the transmitter is designed, in some cases, if the transmitter sees a short circuit, it might start drawing twice the normal amount of current and burn up that final transistor real fast. If it sees an open circuit, depending on the design, it might draw very little current, might. Sometimes everything is reversed. So your transmitter is going to behave differently for short or open. In reality, the short or open on the far end of the line, because your line is not exact multiple of a half wavelength, it's going to fall somewhere else on the perimeter of the Smith chart. A short might fall at the 12 o'clock position in an open mic fold at the 6 o'clock position because your particular line length. The transmitter will behave differently, undesirably, in all of those conditions. So, yes, in either case, all the power is reflected, all the energy is reflected, but it's reflected with a very different phase.
Repeater, timeout.
But it's reflected with a very different phase angle. And that phase angle makes a big difference as to how the transmitter behaves. I think I was hearing a person on Echolink. Who was that? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
W2LA1. I hear my audio is a little low, but I'm making it. A basic thing you might want to try with this cable problem is simply measuring the continuity of the cable. With the antenna off the mount, take a digital VOM and measure across the cable. You should measure 30 megs or higher with a digital VOM. If you measure something less, it might tell you that you have water moisture in the NMO mount of the cable. That might give you some real problems, 1200 megs.
Hey, there's a guy with a thinking cap. Why the hell didn't we talk to you earlier? Yeah, the most basic of all tests, your ohmmeter test, could quite possibly give you a hell of a lot of information in a hurry, Steve. So I'm pretty sure you own a digital voltmeter, and it's worth a try. KC2MDP, K2IW, I hope you're still with us. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, Dick. Yes, as a matter of fact, that's one of the first things I did. I measured for an open, and I measured for a short to make sure, you know, I had 0 ohms, and that's exactly what I got.
Okay, you got 0 ohms with the short. Roughly how many ohms did you get with the open, Steve? Go ahead.
Well, I was using a Fluke. I think it's a Fluke 77. I'm not sure, you know, what the scale is on that, but it was reading, infinite ohms.
That's a very good sign. On most digital voltmeters, infinite ohms is in the high mega ohms. Very good sign. So you've passed the first test. You've got the, and from what you're just telling us now, I think you've got the 95% confidence confirmation that your transmission line is probably in reasonably good shape. And if there's water in the system, maybe it's inside the NMO itself, but I doubt it. And so, an interesting research story, and looking forward to the further measurements on the correction of all of this, Steve. Please come back and let us know. We're way beyond the point where we should have gone over to the mailbag. So, KC2M. Oh, boy, I'm in great shape today. Who is that guy in Staten Island? KC2WGB. I never heard of him. Go ahead, John. And are they going to stomp us again this week? You got it, John. K2IW.
Good evening, Dick. I don't think so. I hope everybody had a Merry Christmas, enjoyed the holiday. We have one question here. I'm glad Eric's aboard, and between you and Eric, you might be able to put out some good information on this question. KD2WDS is asking, in the repeater systems, are they designed differently, and are they protected more from EMP than a standard transceiver that you purchase? Is there any provisions for EMP protection in the repeaters is what I believe he's asking. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
ZVZU and FASTCOM.
Okay, we're going to pick up that FASTCOM at first and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Hal.
Where you have a duplexer, your chances of EMP are a lot less coming through the antenna because you are going through an isolated section of a duplexer. But there's a risk still is a possibility. Go ahead, that's my fast answer.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple of words to that, and I agree. The electromagnetic pulse coming to the vicinity of a repeater, the thing that should pick up the most amount of the pulse at first, of course, is the antenna. It's exposed to the air. The EMP is coming through the air. The antenna's got a beautiful coupling to the air. It has the ability to pick up a lot of the signal. But for that signal to get past a well-operating duplexing filter, the duplexing filter that you've got on a repeater, assume it's a single-site repeater. In other words, you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna. the beefiness, the strong arm characteristics of that duplexing filter, for you to get a significant pulse of energy through it is very difficult. And for the amount of pulse that gets through to being able to do damage to the rest of the equipment, there's very little of that under normal circumstances. However, depending on the range to the EMP, if a nuclear device at a fairly close range, making a huge amount of volts per meter of EMP, is exposed to all of your electronics, the 110-volt line, the wiring to the power supply and whatever, all of these things can pick up voltages. And those voltages can, in some cases, be thousands of volts per meter. In other words, every meter of wire is going to pick up thousands of volts in the worst-case scenario. And so I don't think you really got to worry about that. So that worst-case scenario, let me drop that. That worst-case scenario, if the source of the EMP is close enough to give you those kind of voltage stresses to your system, the blast from that thing is probably also going to get you. And so it's academic as to which is going to cause the most amount of damage. One of the funny things that I remember reading in the last couple of weeks is that some people have naively said that, when NASA is studying near-Earth objects, comets and asteroids that are potentially capable of hitting the Earth, that when we start seeing one of those, we'll just send up a nuclear device alongside and blast it to kingdom come. Sounds great. Not so good. You might really take an asteroid and, in the best case, break it up into a whole lot of pieces. Instead of one great big chunk hitting you, you got a whole lot of pieces hitting you. Well, there's goods and bads of that. However, the nuclear device, when it explodes, it creates a tremendous number of high-velocity neutrons coming out of there with a huge flux density. Those neutrons hitting the air heats up the air to ridiculously high temperatures. That's what generates the mushroom cloud and the blast. In pure vacuum of space, a nuclear device with those neutrons coming out of there doesn't give you anywhere near the effect you're going to get. Very different things happening. The near surface of the asteroid being hit with those neutrons is going to get hot, and that may not be significant unless there's water encapsulated in that near surface, which immediately gets vaporized, and now you're going to get a blast. Everybody thinks the blast of a nuclear device is similar to TNT. Not necessarily. It's a very different phenomenon. Eric might have some words on this if Eric is still with us. Do you think we have to worry about EMP with our repeaters, Eric? KE2EJ?
Repeater, timeout.
KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Hi, how do you copy me? This is usually a bad spot.
It's a good spot tonight, Eric. Please proceed. You sound good.
Sorry, K2IW, K2J. In the world that I live in, I like to separate things a little bit. Because I talk about EMP in the form of lightning strikes or near lightning strikes and how it affects things. Antennas being on towers, etc., so on and so forth. Your explanation of the duplexer in a single station operation is you got to consider that one of those cavities has two pickup loops, and depending upon what frequency it is, it's separated by an awful lot of air. But when we're talking about high voltages, sometimes you can melt things along the way. But for the most part, the way things are set up, the way towers are structured, any kind of residual voltage that's generated on the tower structure itself is usually pretty much grounded off. And on most good installations, there's some form of isolation, either a gas discharge device or some other form of cavities, which is in the way of getting into it. And don't forget, in the broadcast world, we have to live with direct lightning strikes. It's a little bit different than the two-way radio stuff. So, let me let it drop. And the reason why I like to make a difference is, in today's world of solid-state electronics, when you have a nuclear device, forget about the blast, the neutrons will just mad at anything that looks like a semiconductor. I mean, we do ridiculous things to send semiconductors out into space because they're going to get hit by cosmic particles. And when you put memory together, it's got to be so redundant and have error correction built into it because just a single particle can change a memory location. So it's a different way of thinking, where is it? Today's solid-state stuff, we're talking about a nuclear device, be it an atomic bomb, a hydrogen bomb, a neutron bomb, anything that, that puts off high-energy particles, the semiconductors ain't going to survive. So that's why I kind of separate the nuclear from the EMP, because the EMP happens in the real world all the time.
Here's a question I've never thought about asking, and maybe you've got an answer to it. These USB sticks that I can stick into my USB port of my computer nowadays, I think you can buy them with numbers like 8 gigabytes of capability.
Try 128 gigabytes.
Whoa, boy, am I in the dark ages. My guess is if that device, that USB stick, particularly the high-density one you just described, if that was put into space, unless you've got a lot of error-correcting code, forward error-correcting codes, Viterbi-type stuff and whatever, my guess is a lot of those bits could rather easily be changed by the cosmic rays if that was put into a spacecraft. Am I pessimistic or close, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay, well, here's the interesting thing. The Israelis have put up a number of satellites, usually utilizing not radiation-hardened components, but using consumer components. And they've had pretty good success. So their satellites cost like a tenth of what we spent. But definitely over the years, there's been a lot of experiments showing the real effects of being in low Earth orbit, let alone being out in the Clark Belt, where you have a little bit less protection. In our communication satellites, there's an awful lot of redundancy just to that point, because, I mean, chances are a particle's going to hit you somewhere at some point in time. And it happens here, too, on Earth. That's why your computer actually includes an error correction scheme in it, because your computer just sitting there having something in flash memory, well, not flash memory, but having something in dynamic memory will actually change, and it kind of picks that up and fixes it along the way. Most people don't realize that.
So what you seem to be saying, Eric, is that there are some space agencies in Europe or Asia, for instance, who have used consumer-grade hardware in space, didn't pay the big bucks for space-valued radiation hardening. I know that almost everything NASA has built for Voyager and Kepler and all of these other Curiosity. Many of these spacecraft and probes have used NASA's radiation-hardened hardware, and yet in a number of those cases, the primary memory failed or primary computer failed, and they had to go to the backup computer. I think a number of the space probes had to go to the backup computer. Let's see if Paul can confirm that. WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. I know recently with Curiosity, you know, they have an A and B computer set up. So they had that type of problem where the flash memory was, you know, giving them problems, so they switched over to the B side. And eventually they worked it out and they switched back to the A side. They always like to have a backup. It's happened with Opportunity riding around on Mars, one of the other rovers. They had a similar type of problem years ago. But I know you have problems in space with cameras. Eventually the CCDs start to get affected by reflection. I know that's been a problem. So naturally, you call it space hardened. I guess, you know, they really test the heck out of the stuff that they do send up there. It does happen. Back to you, Dick.
much of the hardware that was put on the B-1B bomber, which I worked on for a decade or two, big bucks were paid in order to have all of that equipment capable of surviving the EMP of a major nuclear device blasting off like a kilometer away, rather close range. So they wanted the hardware to survive that event. And so some pretty big bucks were spent. So even on stuff that's not going into space, that's being used in terrestrial warfare, radiation hardening is something that's kind of real. The good news is that a modern-day memory system, you can pack a whole lot of gigabytes and terabytes into a small package. Some of the early memories, the so-called core memory that was used on Apollo, literally consisted of a great big matrix of a whole bunch of little toroids with wires going through them, and each individual toroid could be set to a 1 or a 0. The computer, let me drop it. It was made by these little old ladies who are doing sewing, so to speak. But the computer that was on board Apollo that landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin onto the moon, by modern standards, is very primitive. However, there is an unsung hero, I've forgotten her name, who worked for Microwave Institute of Technology, who was setting the computer, what's the word for it now? Software is the right word, or operating system. She was generating the design of the operating system for the computer that was on Apollo 11. And the magic that she did is she didn't use normal serial programming. She set up a programming complex such that it set priorities. And so when the computer became overloaded, it said, okay, this is a higher priority. I'm going to continue doing that. And even though I'm overloaded because of this lower priority thing, I'm going to ignore the lower priority thing. Had she not done that, Apollo 11 would not have landed on the moon. They got an error 1201 or whatever it was because an improper checkup list was used for the astronauts. Let me drop. And during that landing sequence, they had by mistake turned on the radar that's used for a link-up when you come back up off the moon. The rendezvous radar was turned on. It should not have been turned on. It was giving a tremendous amount of data to that poor computer. The computer was busy as all hell doing the three-dimensional calculations to try to land the lunar module in the right location on the moon. You don't want to land any old place on the moon. You have to land on a very specific place. You land too far to the east, you're going to be too hot. You're going to be land too far to the west, you're going to be too cold. And the astronaut suits couldn't tolerate those various temperatures. You had to land at a very specific spot. And so the computer was doing these calculations to do that. It was being overloaded. The astronauts were downlinking that information. And eventually Houston said, we can ignore that particular one now that we find out what it was. And so it was that programming of that lady at MIT that made that progress, made that a success. When that was occurring, let me drop. The astronauts were getting down to the point where they were committed to a landing. You would like to think that, if something goes wrong and we're not going to be able to land, we're running out of fuel, we'll just we'll abort the landing and we'll just blast ourselves back up and link up with the command module. They were already down to the point where the amount of time required to blast the explosive bolts to separate the ascent portion of the lunar module from the descending portion, the amount of time is such that they would have already crashed into the moon. They were committed to a landing. So you'd be amazed how close that came to a life and death situation. I think roughly 20 or 30 seconds worth of fuel was left, and when that fuel runs out, you crash into the moon. Is that roughly what you were remember reading on all of this, Paul? WS2N, KQLAW?
Yeah, they said the most they had was 30 seconds, but they could have had 15. But they got down to the wire. Once they get to a certain altitude, by the time you light off abort, it's actually too late. You run out of time. They did that. But understand, because they were going so far downrange, Neil wanted to go further downrange. He didn't like the boulders things that, that were around. That, that was part of the problem, too, because the time when the radar was coming on, you know, came on when it was supposed to, but, you know, he should have been down by, you know, maybe a minute or two earlier. So, you know, the guy that was at Mission Control, I'm trying to think of his